This week on RSBNB Update, we got the tip that the ninjas have struck again, so we look at tooltips, how they're better, and how they can be improved. We also discuss game engine woes and whether Raksha will be the one above all. This is RSBNB Update, episode 805, recorded Thursday, November 26th, 2020. Colossal tooltips. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. This week, Tanis is not here because it is Thanksgiving in the United States. And, Thanksgiving in the United States, and this is something I never understood, and I am just beginning to understand, takes on a whole new meaning when it becomes an entire week-long event in some cases, and you roll the Thursday into the Friday, and you got an entire huge long weekend of it. You know, a four-day long thing. You know, we don't really have any holidays like that in the rest of the world, do we, Sirion?
No. No, we don't.
And I think that if I became an American, that would be one of the things that I would enjoy the most, probably. But perhaps we should say...
You would enjoy stuffing a big chicken and chucking it in an oven.
It's a turkey. It's a turkey, not a chicken.
Yeah, a big chicken.
No, they're different.
It's a big chicken.
They're different animals.
Yeah.
But, you know, we actually do have Thanksgiving in Canada in October, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
So we do it pretty much the same thing, just a little bit differently and a bit less high key than that. And we
here in the UK they really eat turkey for Christmas.
Yeah, we do that too. We do that too.
And the first time I told one of my UK friends that no, in the Netherlands we don't eat turkey for Christmas. We just eat whatever we feel like. I got a truly incredulous look, like. I had just said something, you know. I had just spoken heresy or something like that. Amazing.
Yeah, but we are recording this on Thanksgiving Day, the Thursday. Happy belated Thanksgiving to the Americans listening to this, because you guys will be listening to this on Friday at the earliest and into this weekend. But Sirion is here filling in for Tanis, and you can find the main game at Sirion. I am Shane12088, of course. And this week, we're going to talk about the combat tips, Ninja Strike, amongst a couple of other changes here and there.
I wish they gave me some combat tips. I'm not very good at combat.
I mean, combat tool tips. Yeah, I mean, combat tips would be good, too. But we're going to need those with the upcoming boss, Raksha, which we have a bit of information about in a lore stream that will go through, so that should be some good fun on that. And if you guys want to follow along for this episode, you can find full show notes at update.rsbnb.com. And if you want to support the podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/rsbnb, and you have until November 30th, the end of the day, there to sign up. And if you sign up before the end of November 30th, before the December billing cycle begins, you will receive a very special, a very unique, self-designed, by the producers, RSBNB Update Christmas card, if you elect to provide shipping information. But more on that later. All right. Combat tool tips and quality of life. And, you know, I think we should just dive in to the tool tips on this, because no matter where it came from, whether it was something that was suggested by the PAG or it was something that Jagex came up with on their own, this is something that I think anybody who does combat in this game should hopefully be paying attention to and be happy that we have this as an update. But of course, there's questions we have about this, isn't there? So
always.
Yeah. So let's dive in with the tool tips. All combat abilities have been rewritten for clarity and readability, and all of them now follow a bullet point template information where the following information is presented if applicable. flavor text, which describes the ability and mentions whether it has a bleed or burn effect. The primary damage range of the ability, including minimum and maximum damage. Secondary or conditional damage figures. Whether the ability is channeled or inflicts damage over time. And whether the ability behaves different in PvP situations. And this is what they say will be part of the general combat ability tooltip on this. And also with this say that they've made various consistency changes as well. Now, I'm just going to go over a few more of these points here, then we'll talk about some of the tooltip examples and talk about whether we feel it's better. The terms weapon damage and active spell damage are now consistently referred to as ability damage. That's good to know, actually, because ability damage was its own thing that was talked about in various interfaces before, and it seemed and felt like that that was different than the actual damage that you were doing. Keywords such as effects and values are highlighted in white text. Durations are now shown in exact seconds to account for game ticks. What are you chuckling about?
Yeah, game ticks.
Yeah.
I hate them.
Yeah. All combat abilities now have an icon indicating whether they are single target, multi-target, self-target, or area of effect. And I think this is the point in time where we can jump in.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed the icons, and I only knew what they meant because I knew they added these icons. If I didn't have that context, I'd have a hard time figuring out what an arrow pointing to a dot means.
That's a single target one.
That's a single target one. And then there is one that is a face with two arrows pointing to it.
That's the self ability, right?
That's the self ability. Then there is a circle with arrows pointing outwards.
Yeah.
That's an area of effect. And then the last one, I forgot how it looked like.
Multi-target would be something like...
Ricochet?
Yeah, I'm looking at the ranged ones right now as well myself. That's an easy
one. It's free. It's an arrow splitting in three with three dots. Ricochet is an example. You know, the icons work, right? Like we could figure out what they mean, but we have the context of what they actually are meant to mean.
Because we have the show notes right here, or the dev notes right here.
Yeah. If you came into the game and you didn't know what the icon was even there to represent, you know, maybe it's maybe it represents the timeline, right? Like maybe if you use Ricochet, you cause a split timeline, and in one of them the Elder Gods win and the others don't, right? Like, you know, it could be anything. Like if you don't know the context, it could be anything. And I think you'll have a hard time figuring out what it means.
Yeah, the AoE one makes no sense to me.
I mean, it's an area spell, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the way to look at it.
Yeah, but, I mean, it doesn't even look like arrows to me. I mean, and maybe it's just I'm not seeing things properly, but it just looks like dots on the periphery of a rectangle.
Now, I think it's fine, right? Like, the icons are individually distinct enough.
Yes, and that was going to be my next point.
The thing is, there is no in-game way to learn about the meaning of these icons. Like,
yeah.
Well, it's in a tooltip, first of all, so you can't hover over something in a tooltip. So that's the first problem.
And even if you take it to the powers interface and drag the...
Exactly.
And drag it to the right-hand side where you can learn more about it, there's things you could look like you could hover on, but nothing happens with that.
Yes. Like, that's the thing, right? Like, a lot of games, you know, there's an icon that shows, like, the damage type. If you have, like, elemental damage in some RPGs.
Yeah.
Like, things like that, it's fine. As long as there's a way to sort of teach yourself these icons. And I think that's sort of missing
like
here.
Like, if you see something that looks like a, like a wind gust, you're going to know it's an air spell. If you see something with a flame, you're going to know it's fire.
Yeah, those icons tend to be pretty straightforward, but you know, sometimes you get unconventional elements like force or, you know, arcana and things like that. So it's not always, and I think that's fine. You just, I think it should be a principle that, you know, we're no longer living in the 70s or 80s where you needed a manual to play a game. We're past that time. Like, a game should be able to teach itself, and we have tutorials for that, but you know, you don't want to I've seen games where they just go and explain the interface like bit for bit, and ideally you want the interface to be structured in such a way that you can teach yourself what each of these icons mean. Like, I could just hover over it
so that it's learnable. Tell me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's my biggest gripe.
But you know what the really interesting thing is? Is that, you know, if we're looking at Ricochet, like you mentioned, and you have and you see the requirements down below, you can hover over it. And it says 12 ranged and dual wielding weapons. Granted, yeah. I'm looking at Needle Strike now, but you can definitely hover over the stuff in the bottom.
Yes, exactly. And I think the dual wielding ranged weapons, I think that's an important one, because that icon is also not super clear. The ranged one, of course, you can learn the ranged icon from other places, but I mean, that's exactly what I would hope for the icons in the top to be as well, because I showed you the example earlier in pre-show, which is in the defense tab. Let's see if I can find which one it was again.
Let's see what it built. Yeah, because...
Revenge, right?
Revenge.
It's the fourth one in the defensive abilities. You know, it's a self skill. And there's 45 seconds in the top right next to the hourglass. And with the new bullet points, they added a duration as a bullet point as well, which is 19.2. And that was a source of confusion for me when I looked at it, because I was like, but there's a time-related icon that says 45 seconds up there.
And that's the cooldown. 19...
And that's the cooldown. So, I mean, in a way, the cooldown to me sounds less important than the duration. So I think there's improvements to be made. Like, in a way... Yeah, like Resonance has the duration, like as the second bullet point, right? So it's really not discoverable. Like to me, it almost makes sense that duration has its own, you know, little icon slot.
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, you could put it right up there with the cooldown.
Exactly. Like if you hover over these abilities, you see there's like five squares, which are sort of the requirements. Like, those are pretty clear, right? Like, you can teach yourself what they mean.
Yeah, and it says right underneath. Like, one is defense and one is shield.
Like, if they had just made, like... In a way, if they had just made, like, a second row, or maybe even reused these ones, and used them for things like duration and, like, the icons of what type of spell it is, like, what the target of the spell is, I think, like... It doesn't remove a lot of clarity, and I think it's much more learnable and much more scannable for someone who's familiar with the UI.
Yeah, and you know, the biggest thing about this is that anybody who's not listening to this podcast or doesn't have the patch notes up from this week won't know what the four different icons of ability types means.
Yes.
Without looking at the patch notes or listening to this.
Yes.
And that's a big point.
So I definitely think this is a great step in the right direction.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I shall tell you, like, when I read this, the first thing that came up in my mind is that this immediately makes the game feel a lot more mature. Like, a lot more professional. If you just take the time to present information in a digestible and scannable format, that's a good thing. But as you can see from our current discussion, I also think we have a very long way to go. I think going from free from text to this, it's just a first step in hopefully many.
Yeah, and you know, these descriptions have been the same since EOC came out, so yeah. That was a long time ago, and people they do but the back of their own hand. But for somebody who is coming in, who is a brand new player, who's going to download mobile in early 2021, isn't going to have the slightest idea. And that's why this is important.
Yeah. Now, I'm bashing a tiny bit on this, right? I want to say, you know, yes, tiny bit. But also, it is an improvement. And if you want to, like, test how much of an improvement it is, like, go to some of these abilities, try to understand what they're doing, right? Try to get a feel for the new system. Then go to the Prayers tab and try interpreting that.
Yep. Yep, it's that's a very good example. Very good example.
And I think if you go to like combat magic, like I have Lunas active right now, so I can't really Same. Check. But you know, like I think like even here, you know, like there's a heal your familiar, boost its combat stats, and extends its lifetime by 20% of its starting value. You know, that should be 3 bullet points. You know, that's spiritual healing, for example. So, you know, for all the problems we're having with the ability or the new combat with the combat information in general, I kind of hope they bring this new tooltip style to magic spells and prayers.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the melee ones right now, and they are much improved.
So, yes,
and you know, we're highlighting the little niggles here and there, but overall, this is a good update.
Yes.
At least that's how I feel on this.
Like channeled attack here, I see. It's a bullet point. Could also be an icon, I think. Like it's a teachable icon.
Yeah. I know what a channeled attack is. Do you think that's something that needs to be explained?
No, I don't think it needs to be explained. But like the icon should be, right? If you add an icon.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Also, please make it just possible to click abilities to see the details. Like, the dragging is a bit...
Oh, good point. Yeah.
That's a bit... I realized that was a feature today. So,
yep.
That discoverable.
Yep, and I don't know how this interaction would work on mobile, thinking about it. So, that's another thing that is weird.
Yeah.
And I was talking about in pre-show as well, is that I didn't know how to get the combat abilities to pop up on mobile in terms of the info behind them. Because, of course, there's no easy hover state. And, I mean, I guess what you would do is you just drag them to the same powers interface. But I've never tried that. I'll have to try that after.
Mm-hmm. So,
let's move on to the next section here. Now, there's also combat quality of life updates, and I'll just run through these. The Asylum Surgeon's ring cooldown now appears on the debuff bar. The Relentless Invention perk cooldown also appears on the debuff bar. A new primal extract recipe has been added, which allows you to turn enhanced replenishment potions into adrenaline renewal potions. Also, did you notice that the wiki links are gone in the patch notes today?
Yeah, I did notice.
Maybe this is a bit of an A-B test, because, I didn't mind them. It just took a little while to get used to. So, that was odd. But the enhanced replenishment potion is a type of power burst potion. They're made by adding an adrenaline crystal to a six dose replenishment potion. And then where is the adrenaline renewal potion? There it is. These ones were always confusing to me when they came out. The way they
I I kind of still feel that I thought to understand herb lore potions, I need like a flowchart.
Yeah.
Of all these potions and how they,
yeah. How they work together. So the previous recipe for adrenaline renewal was primal extract, adrenaline, super adrenaline potion, bottled dinosaur roar, and clean Arbok. Now there's a recipe for primal extract, enhanced replenishment potion 6, dinosaur roar, and Arbok. So it's the same thing. It's just you can sub out either the replenishment potion or the super adrenaline potion. And the replenishment potion, or the super replenishment potion, has adrenaline crystals in it. Well, the replenishment potion in itself is an adrenaline potion and super restore potions. God, you're right. This is very confusing. Have you ever made these in your herb lore?
Nope. I've used adrenaline potions, I think, on a rare occasion. Oh, I think I have a few in the bank for to try and get a platinum challenge.
Oh.
Challenge, Rush of Blood.
All right, that would do it.
Yeah, I have a few in the bank. I have yet to actually hit wave 15. At some point, I bought myself a whole bunch of really expensive PVM stuff. I was like, I'm going to get 100% gear up, get the best of the best stuff, and just try it every week until I get it. And I tried for 3 weeks, and I couldn't get it. And I gave up.
And that never happened, did it?
And by now, all the expensive stuff I bought back then is obsolete and replaced by better stuff. So I think I could probably make it now.
But yeah, I can't make sense. Yeah, I mean, I've heard of them, but I can't make sense of the way the recipe work. And you guys can go figure that out for yourselves on the wiki. Just shows how many complicated paths there are in 120 herb lore. Godbooks, illuminated godbooks, and Erythor's grimoire now toggle off upon death when you have a ring of death equipped, and this behavior is in line with scrimshaws and intended to prevent charges from being wasted while preparing for combat. All right. If I remember, the grimoire is one of the most important Solak drops you can get. Special attacks that require no target can now be activated using the Constitution special attack ability from both the ability book and the action bar. Okay, that's good. So that means that's things like your Excalibur or Dragon Battle Axe attack.
What does the Dragon Battle Axe attack do?
Boost your strength.
Ah.
Yeah.
In case you want to get in that, is it Bandos Fortress? Or
yeah, I mean, if you needed to do that, you're going way far back on that one, but that was a thing way back when. Did you know that one of the things that people actually use when they're mining is actually the Dragon Battle Axe special?
Oh, right, because strength does feed into that now, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And you go into Legacy Combat because you start with 100% adrenaline to do it. The Zaros Godsword and the Eldritch Crossbow have been added to the list of weapons that can be activated without a target, and the full list is as follows. Aha, I was right on the Dragon Battle Axe. But in addition to that, you got the Staff of Light, Staff of Darkness, the Dragon Battle Axe, the Zaros Godsword, and the Eldritch Crossbow. Shouldn't the or no, that's not a special attack. That's a right-click option on the Excalibur, right? To heal yourself. You know, if you're at level 75 combat, the enhanced Excalibur is one of the best offhand weapons you can have. It's basically an offhand abyssal whip. But, yeah. Ready? Move into the patch notes?
Back when abyssal whips were good weapons.
Yeah. I mean, you can get a level 85 one now with the appropriate upgrades if you really want a whip.
I have one, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
You used to have a cool special ability as well, right?
Yes, it did. And I don't know why this wasn't in the patch notes in this section. But the essence of finality and its ornate counterpart can now be dyed with seven new colors using simple dyes. They say, opening up a world of possibilities for presets, keybinds, and inventory management.
So is there the... what does the essence of finality do again?
That's the one that holds a special attack.
Right, so now that you can recolor it, you can have multiple ones, each having a different special attack.
Yes.
All right, people want to spend the money on that.
Yeah, they're still going for about 280 mil, apparently.
Oh, not bad.
Yeah. And, you know, when we had David on the show to discuss this back in August, he said that would be the number one quality of life fix for that amulet.
How dare you have it?
So that's good. All right. Yeah. On to general patch notes now. Graphics and engine improvements.
Yeah, not necessarily an improvement for everyone.
Yeah, and I'll just read the patch note, then I'll tell you my story about this. Added multi-threaded rendering, providing a significant performance boost on CPU bottleneck systems. It's currently supported on Windows only, excluding compatibility mode, Intel HD 3000 graphics or below, and AMD graphic drivers, released before the year 2020. And, you know, I was using the Mac client this week, and the Mac client has never been performing better than it has been this week.
Yeah, I didn't really have, like I said, I had the problems with the flickering of some of the icons.
And you have NVIDIA?
NVIDIA. That seemed to have been frame rate related, because it went away if I dropped my frame rate. These patch notes were not in the patch notes when I read them on Monday. They added them afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And there's been a whole thread following this on the subreddit, curated by Mod Porky. I would have preferred...
Bless him.
Yeah. Anyone who sticks their head out there and goes on that subreddit, you know? Very brave. Very brave. You know, I should check if there's an actual mirror of this on the official forums, because I feel like there should be. But the whole discussion behind this is that it has been an exercise in trying to figure out what exactly was going on. You know, disabling some features like depth of field, ambient occlusion, bloom, shadows, anti-aliasing, and setting water to low apparently helped some people in terms of resolving
these
issues.
Yeah, that sounds like memory issues, right?
I don't know. You tell me. I don't know how the game engine works.
And no, me neither. Like I can only speculate. And my graphics programming knowledge is... I know the basics, but that's about it. So... you know, when we enter this territory of weird crashes, no idea.
Yeah, and you know, just to give an idea, I've been looking since we started talking on this, and I can't really see anything on the forums that would be resolving this. So I think it's safe to say why everybody went to the subreddit on this. I just wish there was a place to go to see this kind of thing that wasn't the subreddit.
I mean, they link to the subreddit on Twitter.
Yeah. But I still wish there was a place to go to see this that wasn't the subreddit.
Yeah, I think... you know, a lot of people are complaining again, and, you know, I'm pretty sure the QA team is getting a lot of shit over this, and...
yeah.
You know... I'm not going to say you're entirely wrong, but, you know, these things happen. Like, this is... writing a game engine is hard. There are, like, a million different types of PCs out there. Making a game engine work on all of them is even harder. So, you know, these things happen. The thing that I find problematic is the fact that they apparently were completely taken by surprise by this, right? Because... the communication isn't the strongest. Like, I feel like if Discord goes down, you know where you can look to see what's going on, right? And there's very clear communication on, like, what is it, discordstatus.com or status.discord.com. They might both work. That's sort of missing for RuneScape, right? Like, as far as I'm aware, there's not a status.runescape.com.
Yeah, you need a status page or a heartbeat page that will show any major system snafus or any kind of outages or bugs that are going on.
Exactly. So first of all, that sounds like, you know, they need a central portal of that. And I think the subreddit, you know, it kind of works, but it's not necessarily official, right?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the best place.
It doesn't feel official. But the second thing that bothers me a lot is that it's now Thursday when we're recording it, and it's still not fixed, right?
Like, yeah, let me
read the... There are still people who can't log into the game.
Yeah. They put out a warm fix on the Thursday at 16:02 game time. It's currently, what, just past almost 10 p.m.?
Yeah. Well, almost 10 p.m., yes.
Yeah, and the warm fix, they say, has seen a significant reduction in crashes, UI rendering issues, and performance drops, but it's not fixed yet because the majority of issues on Intel GPUs are resolved, as well as performance issues on AMD GPUs, but there are some crashes remaining on AMD GPUs. They are going to continue working on this and hope to have it resolved by Monday's game update.
But that's kind of bad, right? Like, if there's an entire week where you can't play a game.
Yeah.
To me, when you make a change, like, you know, added multi-threaded rendering system sounds like a pretty large change. And, you know, you need to account for the fact that might go wrong. You need to have a strategy out of there. Like, in a way, I'm thinking, you know, as soon as they found out on Monday that, you know, all these people's games are broken, and, like, some people could play the game but had, like, ridiculously low FPS, right? Which is still really bad. Like, if that happens at my job, we roll back, right? We just say, sod it, things are broken, that's just not acceptable. We'll roll back to the previous version that we know works, and then we'll look at the fix. Because you can't just, you know, break people's products that they pay for.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not an acceptable level of service.
Right, and you know, I think the question has to be asked is if there was going to be a rollback on this update, if this was at all possible, would it have been possible just to roll back this section of the patch notes and keep the combat fixes in? Or would it be a one bulk thing?
Yeah, and you know, I hear you there, and I definitely think that from the fact that they haven't done a rollback yet, we can make a pretty confident conclusion that rolling back is very, very hard.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because, and you got to start at that point thinking of player save states and whatnot.
Exactly. So, you know, fair enough. I get it. Rollbacks can be hard. We do a lot of work at my, in my day-to-day job, we do a lot of work specifically to allow for rollbacks. And it's extra work on everything we do. So sure, I accept it's not always possible, but, you know, I hope this gets fixed soon. That first of all, and I think we should not all be angry about it, because that's not going to help anyone.
Yeah, not grab the pitchforks.
But I also think that we should hope and maybe ask Jagex to, you know, tell us after this is all done and over and had some time to think it over, what are they going to do to prevent this from happening again?
Yeah,
because that's really, I think, what should happen here, right? Like, we can't really do anything about the current situation, but except for waiting for a fix.
I think the last time we had something this big was the Sigil update, where they once again changed something very low level.
Yeah.
they also early Thursday put out a warm fix that fixed the texture crashing on Intel, improved threaded performance on AMDs, fixed inventory icons, which appeared solid black on Intel, fixed the world appearing black or dark for an extended time after logging in on Intel, fixed texture corruption, especially visible during the login screen on Intel GPUs, fixed missing textures on Intel GPUs, and fixed UI flickering on old Intel GPUs.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's interesting. It really is. And you're right. I think the best thing we can hope for on this is an explanation to some degree of what happened, and also an explanation on what's going to be done to prevent this from happening again, or potential changes that are going to be made.
Yeah, I think that's the most important part, right? And that's the sort of level of accountability involved there. And I think it's super important that... I don't want to say that we demand that, but I think that's... It's the least you can do to your customers.
I agree. All right. Moving on through the patch notes then. A number of changes have been made for the Mac client to improve stability and actually fix High Sierra, one of the previous Mac OS versions, fixing a persistent black or frozen screen. Yeah.
Just in time for Big Sur.
Yeah, the game was broken on High Sierra before this patch.
Oh,
which
so
I think it went High Sierra, Mojave, then Catalina, right?
Something like that.
Yeah. Fixed system alert sound when pressing F1 to F12 or Control plus key on Mac OS. Fixed window size and position not being remembered on Mac OS. Yeah, that was an issue. Fixed a freeze or beach ball on Mac OS when resizing the game window in the lobby or in rare cases when interacting with the lobby.
I've come to hate the beach ball more than the Windows Hourglass, so good.
Fixed a rare crash on exit on Mac OS. Fixed Mac OS system IME appearing in cases such as holding A to rotate camera.
IME?
I don't know. I'm going to test this right now. I have a theory of what this might be, and I think... what they're talking about is that if you hold a certain letter on the Mac, you would get a little pop-up that allows you to insert an accented character.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what this is.
Yeah, that's what it is.
That's actually really good. That was one of my annoyances for a long time on this.
Yeah.
I'm glad. And, I actually feel like we're actually getting somewhere now with the Mac client. And that I might not need to get rid of the iMac at this point. But that's a topic for a different day.
I love how a few patch notes in RuneScape make that difference.
Well, I mean, it's what we do here with the iMac. It's 50% of the reason I have it.
Yeah, fair enough.
So... all right, next up on the patch notes, fixed an issue causing some Android devices to restart the app when connecting or disconnecting a USB keyboard. Fixed an issue causing textures to display incorrectly on the Samsung Galaxy S5. Was that the one that exploded?
Oh.
Fixed a graphical flicker issue on Android devices. Fixed ping display on the World Select screen on Android, iOS, and Linux.
Sounds like a bit of... the ping display itself was fixed. Okay,
Yeah. Fixed the crash when using pinch to zoom gesture on Android.
It's kind of important.
Yeah. Fixed the issue with Android 11 devices, where the interface would be significantly offset from the corners of the screen when gesture navigation was enabled.
Interesting.
Is Android 11 the newest?
Um,
Because I know you guys have all those weird names behind them.
Yeah, yeah. Android 11 is the newest.
All right.
Yeah, it's a shame. I prefer the letters.
Yeah. I just prefer the iOS numbers. But anyways, improve sign-in with Apple and Google sign-in on mobile devices to use overlaid browsers. I think it kicked you out directly to Safari or
something.
Yeah,
I did some weird stuff, yeah.
And now, moving away from the engine fixes, one final one, improve performance of some animations causing FPS dips. Good. Now, for general improvements, hide-and-seek penguins have been updated with their Christmas models, which will appear in-game from December 2nd. I want to see what these ones look like, because I don't know if you've done penguin hunting since they did the ninja fix on them, but the penguin models actually look really good now.
I haven't done actual hunting, but I've come across some naturally.
Stackable items can now be crafted if there's no empty spaces in your inventory. And, you know, when they say crafted, I wonder if that's just the crafting skill or if it's other things as well.
I assume this talks about any of the skills it uses the Makex interface.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing I always come back to is that if you're doing archaeology and you have a full inventory, even if you're using porters, you won't be able to do archaeology. You need to have that one inventory spot open.
Yeah.
So this is the same kind of thing, and I think would be a nice thing to see adjusted at some point. But
I can see the spaghetti that's involved in that.
Yep. Yep. All right. Now something that the PVMers have wanted for a long time, and this is their early Christmas gift. The essence of finality amulets can now be dyed different colors.
Yeah. As discussed before.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Seven different colors. The skill prerequisite for the ever-so-clever achievement has been reduced to 17 farming and 20 construction, with a note that 81 farming and 40 construction are not required if trading rather than breeding Trevor. Because you can actually complete that one just by trading Trevor, believe it or not.
Who's Trevor? What?
The shiny Zygomite.
Oh.
Have you got one of those yet?
No.
He's all adorned and blue and shiny and whatnot.
Oh, I see.
At the beginning, there was a graphical glitch where he looked like a normal Zygomite, and you would only be able to see if he was shiny by going into the animal information.
Mm.
So that was something that was an issue at one point, but, you know, it's been fixed now.
This is one of these things where I'm like, you know, wiki link on that achievement.
Yeah, yeah, and
nice.
You know, a fun thing with this is that Trevor also unlocks as a pet if you want to, after you've bred it for 10,000 beans.
I see.
Yeah. Moving on, the large dragonkin statue north of the Anachronia base camp now counts toward the Stone Cold Observers achievement. Once again, another place a wiki link would have been helpful for Stone Cold Observers.
It's an achievement that requires the player to observe all five large dragonkin statues around Anachronia, excluding the statue at the Anachronia base camp.
Oh. Okay. I wonder if I've done that, because I know I spent a long time running around there getting all those Zygomites and whatnot. Have you done the one where you have to go find all 60 Zygomites?
I have done either the 20 or the 40, whichever gives you the treasure totem piece.
Okay, fair enough. Iron Man accounts are no longer able to receive the medium protein box from the Premier Club. Seems like a big deal.
Yeah?
Yeah. Players will no longer be able to walk through the mining and smithing notice board at the Artisan's Workshop. And you can now enter the mage training arena from the basement with a pet or familiar that you have already summoned. And I believe that's it for the patch notes. Oh, there are a couple here at the end talking about construction contracts from last week. If you complete a contract with all mahogany planks, you will now receive five contracts as intended. And a typo has been fixed in the UI that only became visible after completing a contract. Interesting.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah. 30 seconds. What do you think of construction contracts? Since you weren't here last week. I have
not checked it out yet.
Okay, fair enough. I thought I could put you on the spot.
No, I haven't tried it yet. But from what I've read, it's a nice addition to the skill. Add some depth, basically.
There we go. All right, let's talk about the live stream that this week. There was a JMod Tea Break live stream with mods Jack and Ryan. You can give that a watch if you want. I don't know. There were some fun little things in there about game design and working at Jagex and what a game designer is versus not. So if that's your cup of tea, then give that one a watch. But the one we want to talk about is the lore stream, talking about the upcoming new solo boss in Anachronia, Raksha, launching on December 7th with the live stream. Raksha, the lore so far. I think we're going to have a fun time when we get to the end of this one. Because, you know, they started off kind of slow. They recapped the end of Sliske's endgame, the start of the Dragonkin story, and Desperate Times, which was, you know, I think definitely going to be prerequisite as we move on here, because this is that same storyline that is continuing through Desperate Measures, the Act Track, and now into, of course, Raksha and the Orthan Dig Site to a degree, even though that's slightly tangential. But this is going to be one of the first big bosses that has a huge lore dump associated with it. So we're going to get to the juicy bit at the end of that, because we do actually have a preview of the starting cutscene on that. But talking about the stream and what was actually leading all up to this, and, you know, Reldo has been an important figure in RuneScape for a long time. And they talked about his estimation, because he's, of course, spent time on Anachronia with us. And his estimation is that Orthan was destroyed about 60,000 years ago, and he made this inference based on Dragonkin astronomy, as in where the Dragonkin would have studied the stars and then compared to where they're at today, which I think is a fun little tidbit that, you know, we might get to explore at some point in the future. So good for them at putting that angle in. Now, they also said the overall thing about the Elder Gods, the big thing that is known, is that each generation of Elder Gods remakes the universe. And when that happens, that's that big apocalyptic cataclysmic act that destroys everything. And the exact mechanics of how that works have not been revealed in game, but there is a concrete system of how exactly that works, and it will be revealed through gameplay.
Awesome. We'll be able to experience it firsthand.
Yeah, and, you know, with that, you have to wonder...
When the game dies.
Right? You have to wonder, how exactly is this going to work? If we're going to be able to experience it.
I mean, we're at least on neutral terms with Jazz, so maybe they will just tell us.
Maybe. Maybe they'll just tell us how it works, and we won't have to experience it firsthand.
Or maybe the idea is we'll build a massive simulation within Gilanor and put the Elder Gods in that, and then we can just observe them. I don't know.
I feel like at this point you're discussing the reality of 2020.
Ah, perhaps.
Now, this question came out of left field, but it's going to make sense when we get to the end. What's a Colossus versus a God? Were you aware of RuneScape Colossi before?
No.
All right.
But there's an interesting parallel here with Greek mythology, where you had Titans.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought on this, and that's what appeared in my head, the picture that appeared in my head when they were talking about this. And the answer is that there's a fundamental difference between a god and a colossus. The word god has a lot of baggage associated with it. Belief systems, ideologies, followers, and so on as we know it. Whereas a colossus might not even be able to talk. It's essentially an animal god.
So then why is Tuska a god? Tusca feels more like a Colossus then, right?
Yeah, but didn't the Gobies worship Tusca?
No, right? I think they were just eaten by Tusca.
All right. We'll have to go back to the lore on that, but that's a question we can ask and answer at some point. And I don't think we have any Colossi in RuneScape at this point, do we? Not yet.
Wouldn't know what would be one, no.
A potential plot line with this could have been impressing the Elder Gods, and you're going to absolutely love the way this went. You know, in Desperate Times, Saren suggests building a garden to impress the Elder Gods and finding a location for it. But one of the actual ideas that was actually discussed and they went back and forth on was having the people of Galenor put on a musical for the Elder Gods.
Penguins in space! I want it! I need it! I want Yamaharu and Beatsmaster Durzag to drop the beat.
And, you know, when they were discussing these plot lines, they said that, you know, they could have done this and it would have been perhaps a little bit too silly. But they wanted to keep it to something that, you know, still felt RuneScape-y. And granted, the musical would have, but it wouldn't have conveyed the serious tone that they wanted.
I mean, you know my opinion on the serious tone of the game.
I know.
And I would have absolutely dug the musical. I mean, I love the folk parts of of Desperate Measures. So you know, I think my words were something along the lines of like, let me just play 2 hours of that and I'll be happy person. So make of that what you will.
Then someone asked what Elder God made the needle, and the answer is that it's very jazz themed. But overall, when you're looking at specific Elder artifacts, they aren't made by a specific Elder God. They're tools that the Elder Gods used, and they might have been passed over from previous revisions, as happened with the measure. So that was a good question to get clarification on. Now, turning to Anachronia, which is where the majority of the rest of this live stream is going to focus our discussion of it, the project brief for Anachronia was just to make an island of dinosaur creatures. The lore team then helped provide the explanation behind it, and they say it turned out to be way more interesting and exciting than actually planned. And they effectively wanted to do Fossil Island in RuneScape 3, but they didn't want to do a carbon copy of what Old School had. So That's how they got away with the Island of Dinosaurs. And the lore, the dig site, and everything happening with Karapak as it is right now wasn't initially envisioned when they started Anachronia, the project brief for it.
We're not on webcam, but I'm actually smiling right now because...
You predicted that at the very beginning.
No.
I thought you did.
Maybe. I don't even remember. But the reason I'm smiling is because I imagine these people sitting in a room and coming up with, you know, this explanation, you know, like, we have the Dino Island. How do we explain a Dino Island? And somebody's like, oh, I know. We have, like, the needle. Oh, what if Karapak came in and brought the island forward? You know, all these things start falling into place once you have that, you know, first idea. And I can see how this came to be from that first idea. And,
yeah.
I'm sort of happy for the developers and designers because I know how good it feels when it clicks all
something
together
solid.
Like that. But also we notice, right? Because you know, it's just super solid. Like the whole lore and stuff around Anachronia is just solid. So
yeah. And you know, this actually goes into the next question on this. As to why Karapak brought the island forward is that he needed his laboratory that had his machine in it that could create shadow anima. That was his whole intent for bringing it forward. And granted, you know, we had the brief on Anachronia, but this is the reasoning that they put forward on this. So, I think that's good.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah. And it just fits nicely.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you've read this next bullet point yet or you read ahead on what we're doing here, but I think this next question is one that you're going to be pleased with the answer to. And this is something that you were concerned about a quest or two ago. And the answer, or the question is there pressure to make lore more dramatic and raise the stakes as things progress? And the answer to this is actually two-parter, because the first one is that there's, of course, the pressure to fulfill the promise of the Elder God storyline, which they say is inherently high stakes. But when this story reaches a conclusion, does this mean that the next storyline has to be more apocalyptic and higher stakes than this one? Now, Mod Jack wants it to be not as high stakes. He wants to get back to telling character-driven storylines like RuneScape has done in the past. Moderali feels that like the continuation of high-stakes storylines should be brought back down to the ground. And the plans would be to resolve this apocalyptic threat and not immediately jump into a new one.
That's great. And yeah, I really like that. I think the best comparison I have here is the Marvel Universe, right? Where each of the Avengers movie is like bigger stakes and, you know, it's always more, and always it's the like the first movie it was New York ending, the second movie is the world ending, and the third movie is the galaxy ending, right? You know, half the galaxy actually, and the last movie is the entire galaxy.
Woo!
You know, it needs to be more and more and more, and at some point you run out, and you need to go to these more character-driven stories, which I think the Marvel Universe is actually doing, and sort of going back to some of the characters and fleshing them out. So I'm super happy with this answer, and it's good to see that that the people in charge of developing these storylines are on the same page. So yeah, I'm very, very pleased with this answer.
Because that would have, you know, effectively compartmentalized things and said, okay, we're gonna go back, and you know, it's just gonna keep being one thing after another, and RuneScape 3 is gonna be the vessel to tell these high stakes storylines set in the world of Gilanor, and that's what the lore is gonna be. But that is a complete departure from how things always were. So it's good that we're looking good.
We are getting a sequel to Violet is Blue in December.
Yeah.
And I already know that it's a very strong contender to throw Desperate Measures off the list as best quest of the year, because if it's as good as the original, it's going to be so wholesome that it's going to be the best quest of 2020.
You know, you're really not working with much, and you got three quests this year.
I know, but Desperate Measures was really good, right? It was high stakes, and we know I don't like that, but there was enough lightheartedness in there that, you know, I thought it was a really good quest. But, you know, it's these tiny stories that bring a little smile to our heart that I think make RuneScape what it is today. So I'm sad they didn't go with the musical idea, but it seems like they are they know what RuneScape is, and they wanna make sure to capitalize on that.
Yeah,
that's always very reassuring.
All right, how does Orthon tie into Raksha? Well, the original Orthon dig site was designed at the start of the archaeology development process, but they changed it to be the focus of Dragonkin history, and Raksha, as the boss, will be a lens to explore the different creeds of Dragonkin and key Dragonkin creatures in terms of the lore that you get from it. So that'll be fun. Now, here's an interesting bit, and I don't know if you remember this from back in the day, but one of the things in the Orthon dig site is the Zolo city and the Zolo creatures there, which is pretty high level. And, you know, they were in the original brief for archaeology when they first started designing. And the whole point of this was go back to that tease that they made during the RuneScape Classic or RuneScape 2 era of lizard men. Do you remember that news post?
No.
I got to see if I can pull that up. I try and pull this up once every year or so. But what we effectively had was a posting from sometime in 2004 called Upcoming RuneScape Updates, posted on March 31st, 2004. And on this included a new Viking-style area, frozen lands area, including penguins, mammoths, polar bears, and more, a pyramid quest in the desert full of traps, treasure, and mummies, a barrows area of the undead, good training areas designed for rangers, part four of the Plague City storyline, enchantable rings, more weapons and armor, armored boots, more clothing, special prayer book items, treasure hunt minigame, summoning spells, quest journal, random events, pets and followers, holiday events. And the second to last bullet point on this list was many new monsters such as orcs, lizardmen, and more. And, you know, this is the one that we never got. We never got orcs and lizardmen. And I guess this was the archaeology, Zolo City, was the bit to fulfill that idea of the lizardmen. So that's nice to see that going all the way back like that. Because I remember that post, and for a long time, kept that post handy, and whenever something would come out in 05, 6, 7, I'd tick it off the list there with that. So, nice to see that revealed 16 years later. Now, as for naming of Raksha, it's named based off of a combination that of two dragonkin words that were previously defined, and simple as that. And when they're...
Do we know what they are?
They didn't go into that, actually. Just Rak and Sha, right?
Luckily, Wiki knows and has translated it for us. And Raksha means either the one above all or the one who speaks.
Which makes sense for a Colossus. Mm-hmm. And it was initially... Raksha was initially discovered on the mainland on a coast to the west of Orthyn. Which suggests that it was maybe somewhere around the archaeology campus. More on this after.
Dun, dun, dun!
Next question, is there a specific reason Karapak has such a hate of the Elder Gods? Which I think is an obvious question, but it's good to get these kind of basic questions answered on the live stream. And of course, the answer to this is that the Dragonkin were bound as protectors of the Stone of Jazz and effectively enslaved to the Stone of Jazz by Jazz, and if they tried to go against that, they were subjected to pain and agony. So that's why they're pissed off. No boss requirements. There will be a short mini-quest to start it off. Difficulty will fall between Araxor and Telos. And lore players will be able to go into the room, get the lore bits, without killing the boss. And all major lore will come before the fight.
It's very appreciated.
Yeah, it is. You know, so you're not, you know, having to do 100 kills and hope for a lore book or something like that.
Oh, I'm pretty sure there will be a lore book anyway, but...
But it won't be the Master Quest requirement.
Well, it will probably also be the Master Quest requirement. But it will not be the major lore drop, which is what we really care about.
Interesting. Interesting you point that out, because I took that as saying that all the lore requirements will come from before the boss fight even begins. So we'll have
it
to wait
says
and see.
The major lore, all the major lore comes before the fight, not all the lore becomes before the fight.
Or requirements, on that matter. Mm-hmm. So. There's also a lore tease throughout the fight, and they say players will think it means something, but it won't mean what the players think it means.
That's a bold statement, because now people are going to look into it And if there's anything I've learned from being a DM in Dungeons & Dragons is that the players come up with way more creative ideas than I ever could.
Yeah, and they're, you know, kind of off the charts, too. You know, and, you know, they say, imagine Raksha as a shadow colossus, a demigod made from shadow anima.
Lovely.
Yeah. Should we have a look at the cutscene? Because that was,
yeah, let's do
that, was teased in there. So we'll play that. And, of course, if you guys want to not see this, just mute for the next minute or so. And here we go.
Millennia ago, Gillanor was an untouched, unspoiled wilderness. Only plants and animals lived there, untroubled by language or industry. A handful of elder artifacts had been discarded by the elder gods. One of these was the Codex, a repository of both knowledge and power. When a great beast came across the strange monolith, it couldn't know what awaited. It emerged from the Codex fundamentally changed. It was a colossus, an animal demigod, the ultimate apex predator, unchallenged. When the Dragon King arrived, they were fascinated by the creature. They found it, captured it, and imprisoned it in their city. They called it Raksha. Nothing quite like it has been seen before or since. It was not just a colossus, but a shadow colossus. Its power came not from the elder gods, but from somewhere else. To the priest Kranon, it was a religious inspiration, the source of his heresy. The scientist, Gerapak, took a very different line of inquiry. He experimented until the beast was of no more use to him. I recommend that you do not allow it to leave the complex. The damage it could inflict is considerable.
So what do we learn from that? Oh.
I mean, it's definitely shadow anima.
Yeah.
Right?
And?
Which means... I mean, it also confirms that the monolith is the Codex.
Yes. And the animal got sucked into the Codex and came out transformed.
Which almost implies that the Codex is related to shadow anima, which sounds very unexpected to me. Like, I wouldn't expect... Because isn't shadow anima, like,
poison,
a thing that elder gods
poison to
can't...
the elder gods. Yeah.
Yes. So how would the Codex, which is an elder artifact, infect something with shadow anima, presumably? That does not make sense.
Maybe the Codex is left over from previous revision.
Fascinating.
I
mean, that definitely seems to me then. Or it seems likely to me that the monolith might play a role in the sequel to Desperate Measures then.
Yeah, that would make sense. Another theory that's been batted around by a few people questcaping, amongst others, is that the reason Tony got sucked in and we were able to interact with it is because we have that little bit of Sliske inside of us.
Or maybe Tony is going to come out and he's going to be the boss for the sequel of Desperate Measures.
I think that would be perhaps a bit too far.
Well, I mean, Raksha came out transformed.
Yeah.
So it stands to reason that Tony is going to come out transformed. I imagine that a god named Tony. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. And, you know, you raise a good point about the Shadow Anima and the fact it's an Elder artifact and it interacts with it. And how exactly does that make sense for the Elder Gods? I think the only thing that makes sense on that is the previous revision there. And, you know, with this, this also, I think, implies that the wider lore ramifications for archaeology are probably going to be alluded to in the Raksha lore. Because you remember when archaeology came out, they said that archaeology is setting up the lore for the next year or so, and nobody has managed to figure it out. And they said this in around June or so, after everybody got 99, 120, completed all the mysteries.
I mean, we still got the massive Inquisitor lore drop that needs to be resolved. So
yeah, yeah. I was kind of thinking after our discussion on it that that might be a red herring off to something else and, you know, be kind of its own little off-to-the-side storyline. But
yeah. Or it could be in an even bigger overarching storyline.
Yeah.
And even bigger than Elder Gods.
Right, and maybe that could just be a way of resolving it. But Zaros is also interested in the monolith. You got to remember that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Zaros is probably interested in Shadow Anima as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and the question for that would be why?
Well, he doesn't like the Elder Gods very much. After the Elder God said he was not to be an Elder God.
Yeah, and he we know he, you know, effectively wanted to ascend to become one of them, but Jazz was having none of it.
Exactly, so he might...
He might want to kill them too.
Well, or you know, have some leverage over them. And if he has the power to destroy the Elder Gods, then, you know, perhaps they might just grant him his wish.
But wouldn't that be a bit of a cop-out?
Well, maybe.
I don't know. Are you more interested now than when we started this here?
Yeah, this is kind of cool.
And, you know, the whole idea behind this, I think, comes down to the fact that we are progressing this lore through each update. And I think if we were using the old method of only doing it through quests, we would have had to wait two or three quests to get everything we've had post-Desperate Measures.
Yeah.
So. And a funny thing from Questscaping, also, a creature discovered the Codex, an elder artifact, and it was sucked inside. Now it emerges, and this is exactly what you said, grown to giant size, made a demigod by the power of the Elder Gods, channeling deadly Shadow Anima. Prepare to fight the Shadow Colossus, Guildmaster Tony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was from Questscaping, but... I don't know. I think it's good the players were right that the monolith is the Codex, and that makes sense why they sent that out in the archaeology package and why it plays such a big role on that. So let me just have a quick read on the Codex and see if there's anything else here that should be mentioned about this. Where did that come from? Oh, that's the Raksha teaser. Yeah. But pretty good. Pretty good. Do you think that it could be associated with Wen now that people are saying it? Because remember, that was a discussion we had at the Inquisitor's bit, right?
Yeah, we'll find out.
So. Fun.
I think this is a good example of like sort of making the game feel alive. Like these lore drops, just telling the story to the time, and you know, you don't have to care. You can ignore all the lore books and all that stuff. But if you do, this make sure that there is always some momentum in the game.
Yeah.
It's not just sitting still. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good. It's exciting.
All righty. Well, we're going to move on. We do have a listener question from Diana. We'll talk about that. But before we do that, I'll just thank our Patreon supporters for this episode of making everything we do here possible. This week, I'd like to thank Alvaro L., Andrew C., Brock H., Cameron, Christian S., Diana, Duramax, Jade Gizmo, Jade W., Jason S., Joe M., John P., Keski, Kyle, Nora, Rastafa, Ricky A., Samantha R., Soupfinder, Stubbeve, The Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V., and Zan. Thank you, all of you, for your support. It truly means the world to us. And if you're wondering what this is all about, check us out at patreon.com/rsbnb. You have until Monday, end of Monday, November 30th, to sign up to take advantage of our special offer of receiving a unique self-designed Christmas card from RSBNB Update. And, you know, you sign up for any of the tiers, you'll get that. You have to provide your shipping information via the Patreon website. If you want that, if you don't, that's fine. You can just sign up like you normally do. But we do offer three tiers of support. For $1 a month, you get a special mention in our show notes, early access to the show notes, and of course, you help fund the cost for hosting and production of the podcast. For $3 a month, you'll receive a special VIP rank in Discord and a mention on the podcast at the start of the month and access to high-quality stereo versions of the show. And for $5 a month, you'll receive a shout-out each and every week and gain exclusive access to the outtakes that we use for the clip show at the end of the year, which is coming quick at this point. And of course, with all this, we have our round table, which we do sometimes around the middle of the month, sometimes on Double XP weekend. We just have a chat about anything and everything RuneScape related. We have our monthly bit, which this month will be on PVM death cuts, which I think is very timely given the fact we got a boss on the way. And of course, we also have Inside Update, way to get a look at the behind the scenes operations of the podcast. And also movie night, which the poll is up for now at patreon.com/rsbnb. And should we reach the $200 a month tier, we'll produce a line of RSBnb Update merchandise that you can purchase. This will probably include things like t-shirts, mugs, stickers, amongst other things. And Tannis isn't here right now, but should we reach the $500 tier? If ever, and that's a big, big if. I think it's possible, but, you know, it's up to you guys. We'll subject ourselves to some spicy wings, and we'll undertake the tradition known as hot ones, where you'll get to see us experience pain. And Sirion has already said that you'll be bowing out from that one. You won't be taking part in that.
No. If that happens during Thanksgiving week next year or something like that, you're out of luck. You just delay it a week. That's not happening. I would literally catch fire on the first bite. Spicy food does not agree with me.
Well, there we have it. If you want more information, visit patreon.com/rsbnb. Have until November 30th to sign up for our Christmas card offer. But if you just want to sign up normally, that's fine too. Thanks so much, everybody, for your support. All right. So, question from Diana this week. Raksha is a boss that's been given an unusually high level of lore coverage and contextual story. Given the current state of the story, what would your dream lore-backed boss be? And what epic monster from the lore would you like to see introduced into the game?
Yeah, I struggled a bit with this. And
I did too.
Because I'm not that much into lore that I could actually come up with any epic monster from the lore. I just couldn't. That being said, you know, I was thinking about this for a bit, and you know, I think there's a lot of battles, like larger battles being described You know, I think when we talked about Warforge, you know, there's a big, there was a big war going on there, you know, and I think you could do a lot of stuff and very original and creative stuff, I think, around, you know, instead of a traditional boss fight, you know, make it more of a crowd fight or maybe even like a siege, right? Like where, you know, there's more stuff going on. So, you know, I think Warforge is a really interesting angle. Like there's a lot of battling going on there. And I think I found the lore there very interesting anyway. So to me, that sounds like an interesting lore-backed fight. I don't know how it would work, but like going back in time maybe. But
you're invoking the time travel.
I am invoking the time travel, sadly. But there's definitely some stuff there that sounds super interesting to me.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the best I could get. Best I could come up with.
For me, I think it would be a conclusion to the storyline that we're on right now, the Elder Gods storyline. I think that everything we've learned so far has indicated that, unlike Nomad, for example, or unlike Sliske, you're not going to end the storyline with a huge boss fight that deals with combat as we know it. I don't think that's how we're going to end the Elder Gods storyline. I don't. I think what's going to happen, and what I'd like to happen, and I'm perhaps projecting this forward because I don't know if this is possible, but what I'd like to see happen is I'd like to see the Elder God fight, or at least maybe some portion of it, in the final quest of this Elder God storyline, be the introduction of the Skilling Boss that has long been talked about.
Okay.
And, you know, you can say that you would do a base level that is soloable on the quest itself, but when you go after the quest, you'd bring a group of, you know, probably three.
So hear me out, right? The boss battle with the epics getting Elder Gods, yeah, will be a boss battle where you need to dance and act and sing musical songs.
I didn't intend to give you this platform to talk about that, but I mean, if you want to take it that direction, sure.
Maybe it's a musical after all. I do think, yeah, like, it to me, it sounds maybe not an Elder God. Like, I feel making the Elder Gods a boss fight would almost degrade them.
Yeah, sort of, exactly.
Right? Like, they have this unattainable status right now. Like, and you can't touch them.
That's why I don't want it to be a standard boss fight. But you know you're going to have to do something, right?
I mean, I do think it would be really cool to stand off against an actual god at some point. You know, like really, like battle a god and do some cool stuff with that. Yeah,
and you know, I think if we're going things that are based in reality, I think the fight that you get after the V quest that you can repeat, I think that is perhaps right now, before Raksha, the best lore back boss that we have in game right now.
I think Virago, yeah, it's not necessarily lore back.
Not Virago.
No. I know Virago's a different boss, and I know he's not necessarily that lore backed, but he does have a bunch of lore around him, and I think he's a very interesting manifestation of the lore.
I'm of course talking about the Abomination. That was it. I couldn't remember the name. You remember with the Tuska thing, when Tuska was resolved, Virago rose from the ground and headbutted it to kill it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There's some.
I mean, imagine like Tuska having been an actual boss, right? Like in space. Would have been cool.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just thinking there how we'd get to space, but perhaps that's out of the scope of the podcast right now.
Just step in your local ferry wing and you'll go to space anyway. So.
Good point. Good point. You're going to the moon.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Thank you, Diana, for that one. If you guys want to send your own questions in, email them to questions@rsbnb.com or leave them on Twitter @rsbnb. All right. Onwards to tech news we go. So this one is one of your stories, and you know, for the rest of us in the world, we don't necessarily have something like this. And the story here is that the EU Parliament wants to grant consumers throughout the entire EU a right to repair, which is effectively a series of laws and regulations that make it so that if you buy a piece of hardware, you buy a computer or a piece of tech, or you buy anything really, there's going to be a set amount of time after the fact where you're going to be able to either repair it yourself or have it repaired for a decent price. And, you know, this is something we see all too often with smartphones, is that, you know, unless the screen cracks, you basically got to replace the whole darn thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is one of those things where I'm not necessarily a big fan of government interference.
Mm-hmm.
But
same.
I think this is one of those cases where they have been given the chance to sort of self-rectify this, and it's not really coming off the ground, right? Like you chuck away so much devices that, you know, could still work fine, right? Like, I have an old MacBook, 2012 MacBook, and a keyboard book, right? Otherwise, it was an old device, but it was a perfectly fine device. It's a keyboard book. I tried returning it to Apple, right? Like, they allow you to return the device, and basically, if it's a keyboard issue, they won't take it back. Which sounds a bit ridiculous, like you just replaced it, you know? It's probably like a wire that's broken.
Yeah, and I mean, you could, if you were really wanting to, you could go on eBay, get a replacement keyboard for that, and replace it for probably under $30.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it is important that we think about sustainability in the world. I think there is a lot of people have this culture of, you know, if it's not new, it's going in the trash.
Yep.
Which, you know, I think it's wasteful. Like, personally, I will wear shoes or clothes until they basically fall apart, right? And I think, you know, we all need to do a part there, because I think it's just wasteful to do so. And there is, on some components, on laptops and smartphones, there's actually only a very limited supply of the raw resource here in the world, so we do need to be careful with it. So actually I applaud this, despite it being more government regulation, and especially from the EU level. It's good on so many levels, right? It's good for consumer protection, it's good for sustainability. I just think it's bullshit that you buy a device for like $1,000, right, for an iPhone, and after 2 years it's a brick and you can't fix it. How is that acceptable?
Yeah,
like, that's,
yeah,
like if I buy a fridge, so to speak, or any appliance, I expect it to last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
At least.
Mm-hmm.
And my phone is way more expensive than that. Why doesn't that last me 10 years?
Because it's obsolescence.
Yeah, but it's like I understand that these OEMs, which are like phone manufacturers, I understand that they make money from selling new devices. They don't make money from repairing existing devices. Sure, fair enough, but like if he that's the whole point, right? Like if we let them just do whatever is best for profit, we're not going to get the model we all want to have in the world.
And my only concern with doing something like this is that you put it out to a point where you're adding more regulation. And if you add, and if your right to repair is too stringent, you're going to have companies that are, you know, not going to go all the way and effectively make it harder to repair things. Because if they do it right to repair, it's going to come back to them regardless, right? So they're going to say, well, you know, if I can let you take this device down the street to get repaired, or I can let you bring it back to the store where you bought it, I'm going to have you bring it back to the store, because at least then we're putting our employees to work on this. So my only concern is that there would be too much regulation brought in with something like this. And, you know, we were actually just having a discussion in the Discord the other night about what era and what year did the replaceable smartphone battery end, right? The user replaceable one.
Yes. Like laptop batteries even. Like, yeah. I remember you just, you know, clicking a mass of batteries in the back of your laptop. Those were the days.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and you know what was actually interesting in the U.S. election this year? The state of Massachusetts actually passed a right to repair ballot order, meaning that there was a citizen referendum that went forward, and now the state of Massachusetts has to bring in a right to repair law, believe it or not.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So there's definitely that's definitely something to keep our eyes on, Dan. How is that going to pan out for them?
Indeed. All right. Next piece of tech news is following up on our Twitter fleet story from last year. But boy, yeah, we're moving beyond last week. But Twitter fleets are, of course, the feature that allows a Twitter user to share a fleeting thought, as Twitter says, and they'll disappear after a day. But, you know, as with everything you post to the internet, it's there forever. There was a bug that made it so that Twitter fleets could still be seen after they disappeared. And they're supposed to, you know, disappear after 24 hours, just like happens on Snapchat and Instagram with their stories. But they weren't deleting properly and could still be accessed after that deletion period. And, you know, these were fleets that were posted days after they were supposed to have been deleted. And this is something that would have allowed people to effectively access and view a user's fleets without triggering a notification that the fleet had been read. And, you know, the interesting part about that is that if you look at your fleets, you can actually see the number of people who have looked at them. So this was a kind of a behind-the-scenes way of doing that. And they said that they fixed this bug, meaning that the fleets will now expire properly. But they also said that they won't delete a fleet from its server, the Twitter servers, for up to 30 days, and that they may hold on to them longer if the fleets violate rules.
Oh, boy.
So,
like, I'm past the point of being outraged or
no, and I mean, whenever you have a feature like this, it totally makes sense that something like this would happen, right?
Yeah.
But what needs to be clear with this is that not only are your fleets visible, you have to assume this is going to be the same case for Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook and anywhere else that has these disappearing media things. And I don't think people are aware of that.
Nope.
And that's precisely why I brought this in as tech news. Not because of what Twitter has on this, but just because this is something that if you use this feature, it's going to be on the servers for 30 days, and it's probably the same elsewhere, and they're not telling you that. So just be mindful, everybody, what you share in a story, whether it be on the Twitter fleets, the Instagram stories, the Snapchat whatevers, or I don't know, whatever websites you could do this kind of thing on. It's all beyond me, really.
I think it's an important lesson. Like, everything you share on the internet, assume it's there forever, right? Assume it's there forever. Don't trust anybody to delete it. And this is why a concept called forward security is so important.
Yeah.
In short, it means that. How do I best explain this? I don't know. I understand it well enough to explain it myself. But like, basically, forward security means that, you know, if something gets hacked or broken in the future, it doesn't immediately mean that all the old data is insecure.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's sort of the best summary I have. It's a cryptography term, but it's understandable why it's important, because things really just do tend to stay around.
Indeed. One thing that's going to be sticking around is commercials.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if anybody else has noticed this. I've noticed it. You will get YouTube ads now everywhere, even if the creator is not an ad creator. So if you're watching somebody's YouTube videos, a brand new subscriber who is not part of the YouTube monetization platform, there's a chance you'll be shown an ad on YouTube, just like you watch a commercial on TV. And these aren't even necessarily going to be ads at the start of the video. They're going to be ads in the middle of the video, potentially. And that's really disruptive.
I find this such a dick move. You know, I come from a culture where ads are very strictly regulated on TV. I've seen American TV, and I know, like, to me, like it feels like 2 seconds of content is followed by 5 minutes of ads every time. It's very different for us. We tend to have.
Just wait till you see the American medical ads.
Oh no, I have. It's absolutely hilarious. I just sit there giggling because it's so stupid. The fact, in Europe, like, ads are much more regulated. We tend to just get longer blocks, but only 1 or 2 per hour, basically. So it's much more, much less disruptive. It's like, it's the perfect bathroom break opportunity, basically. But I've seen YouTube ads become more and more following that American model of, you know, we're just going to put lots of 5 seconds ads, like, everywhere in the video. And, Up to this point, creators had some level of choice, right, in what they provided. I know that some developers explicitly choose to not use ads, or at least disruptive ads, because they don't subscribe to that idea, right? Like, they don't think that's worth the money. Like, I follow a creator who was very transparent on this about Patreon, where he said, you know, I want to know how much I would earn when I started enabling ads. And he enabled ads on his videos for that month. He shared what he earned on those videos. And he said, it's not insignificant, but also it didn't feel good to enable it. So I disabled them again, and I'm going to rely on my Patreon to have income. And I think that's good. YouTube is, it's not just YouTube ads, right? Like, all these channels
even,
now have, like, these
mid rolls. Honestly.
Like, no, but, like, YouTube videos also have these sponsorships ads now all the time, right? Like, every creator is like, this video is brought to you by, you name it. You know the usual contenders. I'm not going to advertise them here. And I find those disruptive as well, but at least creators could choose not to do them, and I could choose to not watch the creators that did that and have some choice in the matter. But YouTube is sort of slamming their size on this, and I find this very concerning. And
And, you know, we talk about these ads, and none of the money raised from these ads goes to the actual video owners.
If you're not a exactly
right. Like, if you're not part of the monetization platform,
which sure I get it. Like hosting YouTube cannot be a cheap effort.
And you know
right?
what the funniest like this- part was after this started rolling out? You know what the first ads I saw were for?
Mm-hmm.
Google products.
Yeah. I turned off ad personalization on my Google account. So I get very random stuff.
I
don't know. Where's the big competitor? Because
yeah. And they said it was going to be on a limited number of videos from channels not in the YouTube Partner Program, but it doesn't feel limited to me.
I mean, it feels like in the last few months, the number of, every time I go to YouTube, it seems that the number of ads has increased.
Yeah. You know, one way to get around this would be?
And they keep trying to push that YouTube Premium subscription down my throat, and I'm not above paying for ad-free services, right? If I consume them enough, but there is, for some reason, when it comes to YouTube, there is an ethical block for me that I just feel like I can't in good conscience endorse their model. And I'd rather just get myself an ad blocker and get rid of all these ads, right? Because I just can't endorse that model. The predatory stance they have, like that, to me, does not show the responsibility that you, as, let's be honest, monopolist, should be holding. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Why is this not being investigated by, like, this is one of the few cases where I would actually agree with someone looking into like an anti-competitive investigation.
Yeah, because it's impossible to start a competitor to YouTube, and the big competitors that are out there, like BitChute and Rumble, for example, are filled with far right leading videos, honestly. And they're not seen as legit competitors to YouTube on that. And YouTube didn't get its success from modeling the cable TV industry. Because, you know, you look at everything that's happened, even with the YouTube TV subscription, it looks exactly like a cable plan from something like a Comcast or Charter in the U.S. did that.
And look, it is. Yeah.
There is actually one way to have it so that no ads appear on your videos, and it requires a bit of a give and a take from content creators. Do you know what that is?
Swearing, right?
No. Make all your videos designed for children and check that box when you upload.
Yeah, but then all of a sudden you are required to follow a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah.
I remember that someone, because like some, I know some developers had this problem, right? Right, they made game videos, and they were allocated as designed for children.
Yep.
Which meant no ads were rolling on them anymore. So this creator was like, so I guess that's my income gone. So they started interspersing whiskey reviews in the middle of their video, because that's an alcoholic beverage, so that's not designed for children. So like every time in the middle of their video there was like 30 seconds talking about a type of whiskey. Problem solved, right? Like the fact that people have to do these workarounds, and that there is one company, basically one person, let's say one person, that can arbitrarily make these decisions that impact the main source of revenue for a large number of people in the world, is I think everybody should be worried about this.
Yeah, and you know, that goes back to the social dilemma pick of the week as well from a few weeks ago. So
yeah,
tie it all in. Have you had a chance to sit down with that yet?
No.
You should. Christmas break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I have a lot of things that I have planned for my Christmas break. And I will probably be sitting around feeling bored anyway. But that's how breaks go usually for me.
All right. Let's move on. We got two Skill of the Month starting in December. On December 5th, we have a Slayer Skill of the Month that you can sign up for if you want to do some killing. That'll run till the 15th. And on the 15th, we have a Smithing Skill of the Month. That one should be interesting to see. So you can sign up for both of those at rsbnb.com/skotm. All right. Achievements. Not too many this week, which is good. We're coming down off the double XP high. Starting off, we have Daydreamer with 99 Slayer on November 5th. Guy Lafleur with 99 Construction on the 25th as well. Lord Dusty got 120 Construction. That's a big one. JamAndy52 got 99 Archaeology on the 24th. Thieves got 120 Woodcutting on the 24th. One Rib got 99 Construction on the 22nd, as well as Dog Says FTW with 99 Crafting also on the 22nd. Then we have Daydreamer with 99 Mining on November 21st.
Moving on to November 20th, we got Prodigal Gas getting 120 Slayer. Robber getting 120 Fishing twice, apparently.
What?
Spookature.
That's weird.
Well, right. That's what the notes say, Shane.
Okay, I'm we'll fix that.
Reading out the notes. Spookature getting 99 Prayer on November 20. Bulbazard 99 Divination on the November the 19th. Also on the 19th, we got Danny with 99 Smithing, Isarap with 120 Archaeology, and V Nightshade with 99 Archaeology. Well done, everyone.
And that was nice and easy to split apart.
Yeah.
All right, pick of the week time. You're going to go, so what do you got for us?
So I'm going to recommend a series that I have been telling you to watch for a long while now, and I'm going to now tell everybody to watch, which is The Expanse. It's a sci-fi series. It's based on a series of books. The books are really good as well, so if you're more of a book person, then I do recommend reading the books as well. I think they're super interesting. But yeah, it's a sci-fi series in the future. The basic concept is that there's basically three factions. There's the United Earth, there's Mars, and there is the Belt, which is the asteroid belt where a lot of the water that is needed comes from. And there is a super interesting political situation going on here. Where, you know, the belt is sort of, it's the slums of the solar system, basically.
Oh, interesting.
In many ways, like it's where a lot of people went for like opportunity, but economically it's very, very poor. And what the series does really well is it never tells you these things. It does really well at sort of world building by showing you stuff, by paying attention to the details in the background, and there's a lot you can infer from just watching the series and understanding the situation. Like, there's very little actual exposition in the game in the series, so you know that makes it a good series when it comes to storytelling. But the story itself is also pretty good. You know, it's not super special, but that's good story. It does really well in talking about the political tension here, right? Because, you know, there's sort of a dependence between these three factions. So that just makes for really interesting watching. And it really thinks about, you know, what would happen if there was a multi-generational civilization.
What year is it set?
Hmm?
What year is it set in?
I don't know what the year, but you know, maybe like 2 centuries, 1 or 2 centuries in the future.
Okay.
So not yet that far.
All right.
But there are a lot of, you know, there are people who were born in space, grew up there, who don't have the bone density to ever go down to a planet. Right? That's like one of the cases that you deal with in the series.
Yeah, and many people wouldn't realize that when you think
exactly.
about it.
No, exactly. And it does a lot of realistic stuff. Like, it has the most realistic space battles I've ever seen in sci-fi. No pew-pew lasers or, you know, all that stuff. No, like, they have, in the first season, they have a space battle, and they pressurize the entire ship before going into combat. Because there are going to be holes being poked.
And if you have a hole with a pressurized ship, that's going to create a bigger explosion.
No, that's like the air escaping the ship causes momentum in the ship, making the ship harder to control. So you depressurize the ship so you don't have to deal with all that. Because the series thinks about G-forces. It thinks about, you know, how long it takes for things to fly from one place to another. You know, it thinks about the fact that if you go from A to B in the solar system, half the time you are accelerating, then you flip around, and the rest of the time you're decelerating.
Yeah.
It thinks about that, which means that when you go into battle, you go engine first, right? Like, details like that are all throughout the series, and that makes it so much fun to watch because it all makes sense.
It's a level of realism you don't see in sci-fi is what I'm getting.
Exactly, but it's a lot of it is subconscious as well, right? Like, you just watch it and you know subconsciously it makes sense because you know how physics works, and that makes it so good. So yeah, watch it. The reason I recommend it now is that season 5 is actually coming out in a few weeks. It's still going, but the first 4 seasons are there for watching on Amazon Prime. It used to be a sci-fi series.
Sci-fi canceled the series.
Sci-fi canceled the series. There were a lot of fans that wanted to keep the series. That's what happened to sci-fi. And from what I've heard, Jeff Bezos personally had a hand in moving this to Amazon Prime. It's still going strong. So go and watch it. It's really, really good. And it's a lesson in storytelling in many, many ways.
Nice, wonderful. All right, and no, we haven't had this pick of the week before, so that's a very, very good pick of the week. Thank you. All right, let's talk about what we've been up to. Do you want to go first, or shall I?
I shall go. I can go first. Okay. I haven't been doing much in RuneScape, I'll be honest. I've been low-key doing some excavating and gathering materials, but perhaps for the first time ever after the double XP live week, I was burnt out on the grind. I didn't even feel like doing archaeology anymore. It was just like, you know, it was just a grind, so I haven't been playing that much. What I've been doing is I've been playing a different game that came out last week. It's the latest Hyrule Warriors game on the Nintendo Switch, Age of Calamity. It's set in the Zelda universe, but it's a very different game from the Zelda games. It's very hack and slashy. I think it's not quite as satisfying to play as the original Hyrule Warriors, but I'm having a lot of fun with it, so.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Anything else RS related?
No, not really.
All right. As for me, I am closing in on the big 116 archaeology. I'm actually really enjoying the 115 spot because this has 3 out of the 4 relics needed, artifacts needed, for Red Rum 3. Mm. So the 115 spot's really good. And you can pull it off with portals if you didn't want to. Yeah.
I'm a while off, so.
Yeah, and, you know, aside from that, just back to the usual herb farming. Funny story on Double XP weekend. I don't know if I talked about this last week, but last week in wrapping up Double XP, I wound up with double the artifacts needed to get out to 115. So a lot of the time spent after Double XP was actually just gathering materials, and I actually caved and bought about 25 million GP worth of materials. I feel okay with doing that because I herb farmed it.
Yeah,
but you know what the good thing was? After double XP ended, the price of materials were buying for under 15% under market value.
Yeah, I'm currently in that phase where I need a lot of materials to finish off the artifacts I excavated. And there's a temptation to buy it, but I'm not doing it.
And I wound up doing that because I didn't use the flask of Soma with that. So that's...
Right.
That's good. Flask of Soma is the one that removes the soil that you get from it. So that's a little bit less materials that you can pull from that. And with that, you also, of course, get extra precision on that. So I enjoyed that. And I think I'm going to keep on the push for 120. I could have pushed harder on double XP, but I didn't. I'm just still really enjoying the ride. So I still haven't used any bonus XP on it. In actuality, I do have to say that when the bonus XP came out, I did put one small star on it just to see if I would get bonus XP from the tomes. But that's all I used on it. But otherwise, it's all been hand done. So I'm actually quite proud of that, and it's going to be a great accomplishment when I get to 120 on that. So I don't know what the trick's going to be after that. So I kind of don't want archaeology to end. That's why I'm taking my time. So. But I believe that is it for this episode of RSBNB Update. We'll be back next week with the lead up to Raksha and first episode of December. So keep that in mind, folks. It'll be time to start putting together those clips for the clip show. But if you want to subscribe to the podcast, you don't miss any of the last four that are coming for this year. Just check us out at update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, YouTube, Stitcher, practically anything. update.rsbnb.com. The Friends Chat, of course, if you want to chat with us while in game, is Bits Bytes. And if you want to sign up for a Christmas card or just want to support the podcast, you can do that at patreon.com/rsbnb. See you next week, everybody. Take care.
See ya.